and welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Daryl Grove, and I'm joined by a man who's ever so slightly sleep deprived.
Oh my goodness.
And it's all Seattle Portland's fault. His name is Taylor Rockwell. Hello.
Yes, Seattle Portland, and a sprinkling of Zach Goldman on top for his intentional jinxing. But yes.
It is at that damn Yanks fault. Right?
It sure is. I had to wake up to coach at 8 a.m. today. The game, starting at like 11:30 at night on the East Coast, did not help with that.
Yeah, who would have known that the MLS kickoff times were not accurate?
I know,
right? We were promised 10:30.
Not so much.
Not so much. It was a wild, wild game. If you haven't seen it, then you probably shouldn't be listening to the show, so we're going to spoil it for you. It ends with a Portland Timbers victory in the penalty shootout that some players did not know was coming.
No, and I really thought for that reason. Like, I went right up to the line on Twitter of saying, I don't think there's any way Portland don't win this. I really did not believe there was any way Portland were going to win the penalty shootout.
Because, so if anyone is confused, we should probably explain exactly what happened, right? So first leg finished 2-1 to Portland. In Portland. Second leg after 90 minutes was 2-1 to Seattle in Seattle, so level on away goals, which means you go to extra time. The MLS playoff rule is away goals do not scored in extra time don't count for anything extra, right? So there's no way of winning on away goals at that point. But because they traded goals again, so it finished 3-2 to Seattle on the night, so 4-4 overall.
Yep.
Portland players thought they were going through because they'd scored more total away goals overall, and they definitely did, right? I think Blanco was on his knees, like pointing to the heavens.
We should say that, like, we think they did by like the general
impression.
I also
think
you
if I was them, I would definitely try and deny it.
Yes, because they did. Because afterwards, Gio Savarese came out, Portland manager came out and said, like, "Oh no, we were just celebrating because we had played such a good game and forced it to penalties." And I think I don't believe him, one, because, again, we saw the way they all reacted. Five or six players definitely celebrating like they'd won.
It's not just a celebration then. There's definitely, you can see the moment when they find out, no, you haven't won, there's a penalty shootout. And there's a look of disbelief on some players' eyes, right?
But it's also the case that, like, I think a big part of being a successful manager is kind of managing power. And you have to, you don't want to give away too much. You don't want to, like, concede points. And if it were the case that they were super happy to be going to penalties, the implication there is we didn't think we would get this far. And I don't think a coach would ever say that. I think they would say, yeah, but now we got to go again. Yeah, like, they'd be more up for it.
This is Portland Timbers reputation management.
Yes, I think so.
Because it is an error to be not fully prepared so that either Savarese didn't know or hadn't properly communicated to all of his players that away goals do not count in extra time.
Yes. Yeah. And I would then say that, and you saw that at the end of the second part of extra time where it felt like Portland thought they had won by the aggregate scoreline, so they were sitting back and being very defensive. I do think, though, what all of that points to is that Portland had practiced a penalty shootout more, like, consistently than Seattle had.
Why so?
Because I think to go, as I said on Twitter, like, to go from that mental switch of we've won, to, oh, we have to take a penalty shootout.
I see what you're saying.
It's a big adjustment.
And so you're saying they're starting the penalty shootout almost in an emotional and psychological hole because you just thought you'd won the game, now you found out you haven't.
Exactly. Yes, but I think it's why you have, like, really rigorous training if you're going to join the military. It's because they want you to be on autopilot, that you know exactly how to respond to situations.
Yeah.
And I think the way Portland took their penalties, number one, and the way, is it, I always forget properly. It's Atanella, right?
Atanella.
The way he guessed, I think, three out of the four, the only one he doesn't get right is the one that Hantuala Buana, like, really, like, messes with him on. To me, that says Portland practiced a lot and were able to kind of click into, okay, we're in penalty mode now.
Could it be researched? Does Atanella just know which way Seattle are going?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But I think maybe that's part of it. But I think the way, like their Portland's penalties, save for the miss, were all very, very well taken. Like, they're good penalties, except for maybe Asprilla's at the end, and that's because he just laced it.
Oh, because Fry got a hand to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say with Ozzie Alonso's penalty, I think, is the one that sticks out to me where it's reasonably well taken, but if you know where he's going and you just dive that way, Atanella has a chance of saving it, and I believe that's exactly what happened, right?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Even Will Bruins, it's not save, it comes off the post, but I would say Atanella definitely has that covered, which is why I think Will Bruin maybe gets in his head a little bit and puts it too wide instead of reading what's happening and putting it the opposite side.
Yep. All right, I want to take us to talk about the game as a whole and why it was so wild. And I think Atanella is a good pivot point because I think it's all his fault.
Okay.
I think Portland had a game plan. The game plan was working until the 68th minute. And then Atanella dropped Rodriguez's cross. And then the fireworks started. And they went on all the way through to 90 minutes, then all the way through extra time.
I would agree with you.
Yeah.
I think, because the first half, you could say, I did the halftime poll. I asked, like, basically, what is Seattle's biggest concern right now? Is it Portland's defense, Seattle's attack, or the officiating? 41% said Seattle's attack, 34% said officiating. And I do think that there were so many fouls in that first half and in the second half and in extra time.
Yeah.
No fouls in the penalty shootout, surprisingly.
But I wouldn't have ruled it out.
I think that does – I wouldn't either. That does break up the rhythm a little bit, and it makes it harder to kind of establish possession and moving the ball around if you're getting knocked off the ball, or if you're the official letting stuff go, you then can't rely on that call happening if you're Seattle. But I also think, to your point, it was Portland getting numbers back, getting numbers between the ball and the goal, and most importantly for me, when they would break, on the few occasions that Portland sent numbers forward, they sent their wide players forward first. Yep. They never committed numbers through the middle.
They did not. So what, it's Flores and Chara were the two central midfielders. It was very rare for them to join an attack, right? It was mostly Obobese and Valeri, and then the two wide players would basically get involved, and very rarely would you get a midfielder or a fullback join the cause. I think it was all about not overcommitting so you don't get counted on.
Exactly.
You're there with the lead. But also, just when Seattle did have the ball, Portland, I thought, did a really good job of, I think of it as Leicester City-ing, or to make it maybe more sexy, like Rigo Saki's Milan-ing, where you make sure that there's not much room between your defense, midfield, and attack. Like, your four lines in a 4-4-2 are pretty tight, and you're pretty compact and narrow. So you just become this like horrible box that can't be broken down.
Yep, pretty much. Yeah, and I think... Like, I texted you about this, and we'll talk maybe a little bit more about Jose Mourinho later on, strangely enough. But I do think that, like, this system, in moments, reminded me of what United did against Juve, which was sort of sitting back and saying, like, you've got to find a way to get through.
Yeah.
And Seattle didn't really have a player like Bonucci who can play these long balls and really pry open defenses.
Yes.
And so I think it worked. I would say the one sort of downside to what Portland were doing is that I think they were so... focused on not conceding any like high percentage shots and not giving up any easy opportunities, that they were not nearly as focused on retaining possession, and their possession stats as a result were very bad.
I agree.
Throughout the game.
I want to double down on a thing you said about the what we said about Man United and Juventus and Bonucci finding that ball over the top to Ronaldo. I would say that ball should have been on even more against Portland.
Agreed.
Because Portland, even though they were in a very tight 4-4-2 block, they weren't as low and deep as Manchester United were in that game. Sometimes they were quite high up the field, and you would have thought that at some point Kim or who's the other centre-back, Torres could have looked up and seen Raul Ruiz Diaz running in behind. You'd thought maybe that must have been on at least once, but mostly they settled for going to the wings and getting, I want to call them, low percentage crosses in, which didn't work, right? They were mostly headed away until, to get back to my original point, until Atenella drops the ball.
Yes, and really quick other point about that, I agree with you completely, because also you really had much slower pressure from Portland when Seattle had the ball around midfield. So I think they were a little bit looser and higher up compared to like Man United against Juve. But then also they weren't pressuring still. So it felt like there was space and there was time for those balls to come through. Mm-hmm. That didn't really happen. That said, it kind of happens for Seattle's first goal, because it is a long ball played in and it's Atenella just not taking it cleanly.
This is what I'm saying. It's like it's a low percentage cross in the end from Rodriguez, right? Yeah. He's on the left. I think he's been forced backwards and like he's running backwards and just swings a ball in to the far post. And the fact that Atenella gets there so easily is testament to what of a low percentage hit and hope, fingers crossed it is. Mm-hmm. It was a fingers crossed.
Yeah.
He just should have caught that ball, brought it down, and then that attack's dead.
Yeah.
And somehow he drops it. And then this game just opens up and goes wild. Because once Portland have to start committing more numbers forward, then it becomes this crazy end-to-end game of soccer where people charge forward, lose the ball. The other team charge forward, lose the ball. And it just opens up and gets kind of wonderful in terms of spectacle and drama and entertainment, but not wonderful in terms of high quality soccer.
No.
Right?
Certainly not.
It was like low quality soccer played by high quality players in an entertaining way.
Yeah. That all checks out. And I mean, and then it's also weirdly like familiar moments. The late equalizer in the DC United game against Columbus, Nick De Leon's volley, which is headed to him by Giassi Zardes. That feels slightly similar to the go-ahead goal that sent it to extra time for Seattle.
Yeah, that was Raul Ruiz Diaz from a Blanco
header.
There it is. Yeah, that header was very much not good.
It was not. But so, like, there's that similarity, but there's also the case that felt indicative of the way the match had gone, which was, we'll just do whatever we can, just get a body part to it, and hopefully that's enough to keep Seattle from scoring if you're Portland. And I think that's exemplified by the fact, here's a statistic that I feel like might blow your mind a little bit. I looked up the number of like defensive actions in this game. Do you know how many clearances Portland had?
A billion?
I mean, you're...
Let me try and get an actual number. I don't know what's normal in a game, so I've never looked at these numbers. 50.
Seattle had 10.
And 50.
And you are dead on close in that it was 51. 51 clearances from
Portland. I don't know if to feel good I was so close or bad that I was nearly perfect.
I mean, things can be two things. You can do both. But yeah, that says to me that it was a lot of last-ditch defending. I think the same way that there was...
It's sort of Ridgewell and Mabiala headers, essentially,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
And clearances. But yeah, I would bet that the majority of those 51 are concentrated in those two guys.
I would say you're probably right. And then you had 33 total fouls between the two. So I think that also shows you the type of game it was in the beginning, but then definitely became as it went on.
Anything else to say about this game? I mean, I feel like we could go deep into detail on the tactics, but essentially, tactical concerns mostly went out of the window once this game opened up, right?
Yes.
It just became a sort of free-for-all in that weirdly like low-quality entertaining way.
Yeah, I think that's what I would say. I think if you wanted to give these two teams, specifically Portland, the benefit of the doubt, I would say that Savarese made smart substitutions. You look at Dairon Asprilla coming in, what in like the early
scores
like,
a winning penalty eventually,
72nd, 73rd minute, scores a goal, gets an assist, does the defensive work he needs to do in extra time, and scores the decisive penalty.
Yeah.
That's a good shift. That's a good substitution. But the thing that I think is really a credit to Savarese is to be that defensive for that entire game and then to need to get a goal and to go out and get that goal is commendable because it requires you to have a fundamental shift in what you're doing, and that Portland were able to do that fairly quickly and fairly easily as they were able to get that goal. It speaks to the amount of work that they had put in. So I think it's a credit to Savarese and a credit to the Timbers. That said, commiserations to Seattle because that could not have been easy to watch.
No, I'm sure it was rough. Anything else to add?
No.
All right, then let's move on to today's sponsor.
Let's do it.
Because this, but the ad read is Seattle Portland theme.
Okay.
Today's show is sponsored by Roughneck Scarves. Roughneck Scarves are sponsoring today's show. They are the official scarf providers to U.S. soccer and Major League Soccer.
What's happening over there? Did you do the Daryl thing of burying your Roughneck Scarves copy under all of your other notes?
Yeah, but then I did the other Daryl thing of finding it while I was doing the introductory read. So if you haven't pointed it out, no one would have known.
I feel like maybe the frantic paper shuffling may have given it away. Yes, so thank you to Roughneck Scarves. We put out the question, Daryl put out the question more specifically. If you were to design a custom Roughneck Scarf to represent last night's Seattle v. Portland playoff game, what would it look like? Four great answers here, starting with Landon Cotham, who says, maybe just print the away goal rule on it. That checks out. That makes sense.
You could hand it out before the for the next round of playoffs.
No, they knew, Daryl. They totally knew.
Yeah.
I'd say put the away goals rule on one side, and on the other side put the covering like talking point so that when you're asked about it, you can then read that and know exactly what to
just
say.
Flip it around.
Yeah,
to
toe the team line.
So Scuffed, which I assume is Adam Bells on Twitter, says, on the Seattle side, the faces of Marlon Vargas, Joshua Tencio, Danny Robles, Azriel Gonzalez, Alec Diaz, Ray Serrano, and Alfonso Ocampo-Chavez peering into the future. On the Portland side, nothing.
What could that possibly be a reference
to? For people who don't know, Scuffed is referencing the fact that S2 has so many of their academy players coming through and playing there. And then in Scuffed's opinion, not Total Soccer Show's opinion, not officially anyway.
Key distinction.
Portland Timbers are not doing such a good job of bringing youth through. So even though Seattle are out, they can look positively to the future.
All right. Well, I think Portland can be also looking like towards the much nearer future happily, unlike Philip Weiss, who says, it just has my tears.
Yeah, we're going to assume that Philip is a Seattle fan.
I'm going to assume that, yeah.
Yeah. Final one we chose is from Eric Schinnerberger, who says, it would be super long and arrive very, very late.
That is accurate.
Because that is what happened with this game.
Super long scarf that arrives very late. What more could you want this upcoming holiday season? If you wanted to get yourself a Roughneck scarf, or, you know, you can give it as a gift. Maybe you want to send it to a Portland fan as a congratulations moment. You could do that. And you can get 20% off of any order by using Total Soccer Show, all one word, at checkout.
So, yeah, it's roughneckscarves.com. Mm-hmm. Total Soccer Show for 20% off. That only applies to scarves that you see in the store, not the custom scarves you create yourself.
That is accurate, and I agree, and I co-sign that message. So thank you to Roughneck Scarves once again, and once again, it's Total Soccer Show for 20% off.
One final thing I do want to add on the Seattle game is I think Brian Schmetzer, Seattle coach, even though his team lost on penalty kicks, he did the thing that I like coaches to do, which is when you need a goal, don't wait until the last 10 minutes to play like it's the last 10 minutes. I feel like they almost start in the second half. They were very much like, let's get that ball forward and let's go and get it. So I really enjoyed that sort of like early panic button pressing.
Okay. You know I can agree with you a little bit. I do think that both teams waited to make their changes, to make the substitutions. I think Seattle especially held off on some of those subs, so maybe he could have made some changes a little bit faster. But you're right, they did go out and get those goals and almost got the result.
And gave us a very entertaining, but very late.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So, there were other games yesterday.
There were.
There were definitely other games. We're going to talk USL Cup in just a second. But first, the US women's national team went to Portugal, who honestly, I forgot that Portugal had a women's national team because they've never qualified for a World Cup, so I've never really spent much time thinking about them. The US won 1-0 with a semi-experimental roster.
Yes. Yeah. And I would say, based on the Twitter responses I saw, an experimental roster that made people very angry. And it maybe people are just already frustrated or still frustrated with Jill Ellis. But I think the like one side of the prevailing opinion was you have a World Cup 8-9 months away. You need to be treating these as preparation for that tournament, not experimenting and seeing what else you might be able to try. I don't know if I buy into that because the U.S. women have been doing just fine lately. And I think that if you're Jill Ellis, you want to see what other players can do in other positions. I think she wanted to see what some of her regular starters could do in other positions. And so it makes sense to me to experiment in these types of games.
Same here. Yeah, I think when you get very close to the World Cup, that's obviously the time to fine-tune for the World Cup. But when you're 9 months away, I think that is the time to maybe look at roster depth, right? To see, can Andy Sullivan play that number six role successfully? Yeah, to just mix things up a little bit. Jess McDonald got her goal. Like, she got the start, got the goal. So I think I'm all in on experimenting at this, like, 9 months away from the World Cup, I think is perfect.
Yeah, and I also think that Julie Foudy...
And not crazy experimenting, right? It was experiments within the framework of what looks more or less like a first-choice team.
See, that's the key thing for me. Julie Foudy made the point, I think, in the lead-up to the 2015 World Cup. Jill Ellis had talked about a loss to France and how that prepared them for the World Cup a bit more because it made them buckle down and it made them realize some of their shortcomings. And so I think if you look at some of these games as Jill Ellis wanting to see, can this player play the Alex Morgan role or the Kelly O'Hara role and see what players are capable of and especially capable of going to Europe, because this game was in Portugal, as you said, that all matters in terms of building a lineup that can compete when it comes down to the World Cup.
Let's talk about the goal.
Sure.
So McDonald gets the goal, but we couldn't stop watching when we watched the replays and replays and replays of this goal.
Yeah.
Portuguese defender, I think it's Silvia Rebelo.
You got it.
Who I still don't understand how she doesn't cut out this cross from Crystal Dunn.
It comes
right across the front of her, and she just decides not to even extend the leg.
The only thing I can think is that maybe in the half second of deciding to make a play on that ball or not make a play, as is the case here, she maybe has a little bit of paranoia about if you overcommit and you kind of lose your footing, maybe you turn that into your own goal.
Yeah.
But I still think she's more likely to put it out for a corner kick. And especially...
Yeah, she's not like right in front of goal, right? If she gets to it, she still, if she has any faith in her own ability to direct a soccer ball, she can direct that out for a corner kick, not towards goal.
Yes. Yeah? But I think she has a moment of panic and she doesn't want to make that play for fear of making an own goal. So then she doesn't make a play at all. So the ball is able to find Jess McDonald. And then this was the other key thing for me was that then Rebelo kind of panics again because then the shot is
saved. Right? I forgot
and
that.
She tries to like just thump it clear and instead hits McDonald, ball goes into the goal. 1-0 USA.
She banked it off McDonald for a goal.
She did.
Right? Which is not to remove McDonald's role in it. Right? She essentially did a good job of then blocking the attempted clearance. So you very much deserve the goal just for that reason.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. But I think it's also a credit to Crystal Dunn because it's a really it is a good ball in, even if maybe it should have been cut out. It's a smart ball in after she makes a good run. But it also led us to be confused because Crystal Dunn was playing, theoretically, left back in a 4-3-3.
And this goal, this assist comes from being what I would call a right winger or a right wing back.
Yes.
And we went and double checked all this. She's playing, she's playing left back all the way up until this point. She briefly switches to right wing back. It looks like the US winger back three, gets this assist. They set up the half in that shape, go back to the second half, and the US is back to a 4-3-3.
Yes. So I think maybe maybe they just wanted to try. And that does kind of coincide with a period when Portugal started to get a few chances of their own. Mm-hmm. They got a couple corner kicks in quick succession. And it felt like maybe the United States just wanted to change it up a little bit and get a different look and see how that would impact the game. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe where you had that 10-minute, 15-minute change. And it's worth noting that that's when they scored. So maybe it worked for the best. But maybe it's not something we'll see too much because it still led to, in my opinion, players not entirely knowing where they were supposed to be. And so you ended up having 3 and 4 players thinking that maybe they were the right back for the U.S. in moments. And I don't know if maybe they hadn't practiced that shift enough or maybe they just kind of all were so up for it that they were trying to make plays. But that is a thing that you probably want to work on a little bit more heading into the World Cup.
And again, Portugal never qualified for a World Cup. I don't know how good the Scottish women's national team is, but that's who the U.S. plays next. I do know if Kim Little's on the field, then there's at least one really dangerous player for the U.S. to worry about. And I'm not sure you can say that about Portugal.
That makes sense. Yeah. I would also say that Mike Myers once told us that if it ain't Scottish, it's crap. So, I mean, you know, that's got to factor into that one a little bit. I'm not sure it has to, but I'm choosing to let it.
Okay. That's your preview of that game?
Yeah, pretty much.
Is that Mike Myers or Michael Myers?
That would be Mike Myers.
Mike Myers, okay. Yes. Very different people.
Yes. Michael Myers is not known for his sense of humor.
Good timing. Also, last night, Thursday, it was the USL Cup final. It was Louisville City hosting Phoenix Rising. Mm-hmm.
Or if you were doing the promo for this, Louisville City versus Didier Drogba.
I mean, honestly, that's at least I watched the second half. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the reason I watched it. I was like, all right, let's see.
Yeah.
Let's see what Drogba does in his last ever game. Mm-hmm. What he did was be on a team that conceded. So there was a very scrappy goal scored by Luke Spencer in the second half. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, it was all it was Phoenix attacking and essentially looking for Didier Drogba in the box. They kind of found him a couple of times. Mm-hmm. He had one overhead kick, which he sort of had a swing and a miss. And he had a header late on where he headed it wide. There's also a lot of Didier Drogba receiving the ball at midfield and then trying to drive forward and getting basically taken down somewhere along the way.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I have a question for you because I did not watch this game. Was this a case of Didier Drogba just is the best player and so he kept finding these moments or kept almost finding moments? Or was it the case of when you have that marquee big name player that you're kind of putting all of your hopes on that you end up playing the ball to that player all the time?
I got the feeling it was the latter.
Okay.
Not in a massively self-destructive kind of way because it would be sort of they wouldn't serve in a cross from a stupid angle to find Drogba. They would work it and try and find a better angle. Mm-hmm. But with the end goal being, let's serve the ball in to find Didier Drogba.
That makes sense.
I'm also want to be careful what I say because I haven't watched Phoenix Rising all season. And it's been whatever they've been doing has been good enough to get them to USL Cup, right? So it's not as – I think one-man teams always fail. So it can't just be a one-man team if they've managed to get this far.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, sure. But I would also say we should give credit to what Louisville have done because, worth noting, this is 2 in a row. It's back-to-back championships.
2 in a row. Someone noted that it's quite rare to win the second division twice in a row because normally you get promoted.
There we go. That's a bummer, but also accurate. It was a good, semi-good moment for Richmond Kickers fans because there were, two ex-Kickers players on the field, so that's good.
At least George Davis IV was on there, and Brian Ombi almost made the game 2-0 when he went, it's not quite coast-to-coast, but it was his own penalty area to the opposition penalty area, dribbling past multiple people. He got stuck right at the end. That would have been the crowning glory of this game if Brian Ombi had made it 2-0. Yeah.
But I think Louisville fans will take a 1-0 win all the same.
So congratulations to Louisville. I know we have a lot of listeners who are Louisville fans. I know Louisville City are doing good things in terms of getting a real soccer market going in Louisville. I believe they have MLS expansion plans. But in the meantime, if you just keep on winning USL every year, that's something to enjoy.
When Laura Coots, Josh Dankus, and I did the show 5 years ago, maybe at this point, discussing which city should get an MLS expansion, Louisville were my nominee. So I'm always going to advocate on their behalf, and maybe consistently winning will do that.
Uh-huh.
Maybe. That and several hundred million dollars.
I think the latter is slightly more helpful than the former.
You need both.
Today's show, before we get to listener questions, today's show is also sponsored by one of our wonderful new sponsors, Loop Jewelry. Mm-hmm. Loop is special. It's an engagement ring. It's engagement ring shopping for the modern couple. Mm-hmm. So essentially, if you're shopping for an engagement ring, rather than going blind and taking a big risk, you can go to Loop Jewelry and you can ask them, hey, can you please walk me through the process.
Yes.
So it basically prevents you from making a giant mistake.
That's good. You never really want to walk away from a engagement shopping experience or purchasing experience mm-hmm. saying I've made a huge mistake. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure Joe Bluth. but the other thing that they will do, because they're detail obsessed and committed to quality, all of their diamonds are responsibly sourced and pre-screened by a diamond expert, since certificates don't tell the whole story. That is true. They can give you a piece of paper saying this is an amazing diamond. But it probably should say more than just amazing diamond. I feel like there's a little bit more to the certification process. They check each one individually, so you'll always get a top-tier diamond that meets the highest quality standards.
And the people at Loop are experts. Mm-hmm. They are diamond industry pros. They are ring industry pros. They have left their old corporate jobs to form this company to give you a different experience of shopping for an engagement ring. So if you go to loopjewelry.com/pages/TSS, mm-hmm. the link will be in the show notes, you will get $100 off if you spend $1,000 or more with loopjewelry.com. Mm-hmm. It's definitely one of the bigger ticket items we've ever advertised
yeah.
on the Total Soccer Show, but that's what engagement rings are all about, right? So if you're going to spend that much money, you might as well do it right, have an expert walk you through it. Mm-hmm. loopjewelry.com/pages/TSS.
I'm just throwing this out there. Don't put so much pressure on yourself. It's like anything that yeah. you're doing for your significant other, for your partner. Like, if you were going to buy them a sweater, you would want it to match the things that you think they would like and like also representative of what you think of them. So just do the yeah. same thing with a diamond. Loop will help you out with the rest and you're good to go.
The pressure should be exerted on the diamonds over millions of years
there we
forming
go.
The diamond, mm-hmm. not on you when you're buying one.
Well said, my friend. That's not even in the copy. Joe not. Grove just came up with that on his own. That man has copywriting experience, I'm guessing.
So thank you to Loop Jewelry for sponsoring today's show. Once again, mm-hmm. the link is in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
This show has been fast moving and
it
full
has.
Of action. It has been just like Seattle, Portland.
Just like it. Which means you have to listen to this after midnight whenever it comes out.
We also have two listener questions that we're very excited to answer. The first question mm-hmm. is, full disclosure, from a friend and teammate of ours, Patrick Kennedy.
He's an associate.
He's an associate. He's a Sunday soccer acquaintance.
There we go.
But Patrick hasn't asked a question in a while, so I'm excited. I was excited right. when it popped uh-huh. up. Patrick has a good question. How would the big coaches do in Major League Soccer? Mm-hmm. Would limitations and salary caps expose flaws and weaknesses?
I think the answer is yes for some, less so for others.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
Because I would just say, like, Guardiola, Klopp, I think they would have a little bit harder time than, honestly, a manager like Jose Mourinho. A more defensive manager, I think, could be better suited to Major League Soccer than people who are reliant on a lot of technique and technical ability and overall tactical awareness.
Okay, I've got a different take.
Okay.
I actually think everyone you just named, mm-hmm. Klopp, Guardiola, Mourinho, mm-hmm. would do just fine in Major League Soccer because they're detail-oriented.
Okay.
And I think the level of detail that Klopp has, we've seen him apply at Liverpool and at Dortmund, mm-hmm. the level of detail Guardiola seems to take everywhere he goes. And the same for Mourinho, obviously, with all his dossiers. Mm-hmm. I think they would still be successful because I think Major League Soccer rewards you for finding little advantages in the margins. I think the people who would struggle would be the type of coaches who just sort of, I want to say like Harry Redknapp, mm-hmm. the sort of coach that just like I could just imagine him not taking the time
yeah.
to learn the rules
I mean,
and regulations.
We saw it in the form of Ruud Gullit.
Yes, no,
yeah.
he's the best example, right?
Yeah.
Just absolutely did not understand it. Mm-mm. If you come in with just a bit of a celebrity, hey, I'm the best kind of mm-hmm. way, I think you'll struggle. If you come in willing to exploit the details, it may even suit you. It may be a good thing for the three big name coaches we just mentioned.
Well, see, let me go back
to... I like they're on opposite sides of this. We've got like a Colin Cowherd thing.
Yeah, because I'll say this about Klopp and Guardiola. I think that the style of play, especially with Liverpool,
yeah.
it's a lot of running. And in a league that is very physical and requires a lot of travel and travel where you're not usually having the accommodation that these coaches might be used to, I think it takes a toll. And you don't then have the money or the squad depth to really be able to counteract that.
Yeah.
Whereas a more defensive, sitting back, keep your shell, you can kind of run that through a whole lot of the time. You can swap out some players, but it's always going to be about keeping that shape. Yes, you still got to run. Don't get me wrong. It's not like you're just sitting back, never exerting yourself. But I think a more defensive-minded manager, Mourinho is the one that comes to mind most readily, but there are plenty of other ones out there. I think they would be maybe slightly better, at least in the first season.
So it seems to me you are arguing more that just Mourinho would do better in Major League Soccer than, say, Klopp or Guardiola.
I think so,
yeah.
Which is a strange thing to advocate,
yeah.
given, you know, the way the world is going.
But I think I really genuinely think all three would do well because I think, I mean, we don't have the evidence that, say, Guardiola can coach a team that doesn't have top-end players, right? Mm. So that's the giant question mark. And I could very easily see someone building an argument that if you don't let Guardiola spend £50 million on fullbacks, maybe he's going to struggle. But I really think if you appointed him, if he took over a team, he would bring this, that sort of aura and weird winning mentality about him. I think it would get a lot of people in the team hyped up and people would buy into his system. Okay. Right? And then on the Klopp side, if you look at what Red Bulls have done, that's a version of at least a high press type thing. They won Supporters Shield that year doing that exact same pressing, not the exact same, but a very similar high energy pressing thing. So there's evidence that pressing works in Major League Soccer.
Okay, that makes sense to me. My question for you then is, when we're talking about big coaches, because Harry Redknapp, not a big coach in my mind anymore, why did you say some would succeed and some wouldn't?
I really think of it as just the more detail-oriented coaches would succeed.
But is there a big coach that you think of as not being detail-oriented, or do you just think it is just anybody who's detail-oriented would be fine, and thus any big coach could handle it?
Oh, now I'm struggling, because in my head, being detail-oriented is the key to success. So anyone who's been successful, I think of them as detail-oriented. But like, I don't know if Maurizio Sarri, for example, who you could maybe call a big coach right now, if he has massive dossiers on the opposition and like specific grids and things where he wants his players to go and things he wants them to do.
All right. Here's one for you. How would Rafa Benitez do in Major League Soccer? Because on the one hand, he's done a very good job, or as good of a job as possible, with Newcastle with no money in the league that they're in. But on the other hand, he is known more so as like a knockout manager who really focuses. Like, I feel like he would do really well in playoffs.
Yeah.
But I don't know if his team would be able to get to the playoffs. So I'm wondering what you think he would be capable of.
I think he's very good at putting up a defensive setup, right? So for that reason alone, I think that would set you up nicely in Major League Soccer.
All right. Yeah. And then I really do, flipping it around though, I really do struggle to think of a big name manager who like is doing really well who would then struggle in Major League Soccer.
I guess the thing is just taking it seriously, right? Maybe if you look at a player example, maybe Wayne Rooney is the model, right? Yeah. Whoever you are, if you come
to
Major League Soccer.
That is such a weird thing to say right now. Yeah.
But if you come and you say, hey, I am going to take this seriously. I'm going to give this everything. I'm going to give this the respect it deserves. I'm not just going to stroll around on a semi-vacation just using my celebrity to pick up a paycheck. I think you're going to be successful. And I think there would be a big changeover. Again, you'd have to read the roster rules and regulations. You'd have to like know all about like which flights you're allowed to take. And then you'd have to plan out the where you would spend your budget on the few charter flights you're allowed to have. There's like a whole new level of stuff that would be new to all these coaches. But I think if you're the type of coach that's capable of succeeding, and you're willing to learn and pay attention, I still think it's very possible to succeed in Major League Soccer.
All right, I've got a very controversial one with all of that said.
Yeah.
I think Carlo Ancelotti doesn't do well in Major League Soccer.
Why is that?
Because by all accounts, he is much more of a relaxed locker room presence. You guys can kind of do what you want as long as you execute the game plan. I don't think of him as so much hyper-focused on all the little details. And I do think that with Major League Soccer, you've got to kind of take all that into consideration. And I do think maybe Ancelotti, a bit more relaxed, doesn't quite have all of the discipline you might need. Not to say that his teams are ill-disciplined, just that you need that next level of what hotel are we staying at and how do I get closer to the stadium so there's less time for preparation or more time for preparation.
Here's who wouldn't do well. Louis van Gaal.
Yeah, that would not be
good. Yeah?
Yeah. I think he would get frustrated really
fast. Yes, that's what I was thinking of. I imagine a level of arrogance where like 10 games in, he's getting really mad and he's like yelling at players for not being able to do certain things.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. That checks out. All that checks out. Again, I don't know if he can I don't know if he's a big manager. So I think anymore at least. So I think you're right then that most big managers
get bigger every time I see him.
Well, that's probably true. That's probably true. But hopefully
I know I kept talking about rules and regulations and that, but I would also say coaches like Guardiola genuinely improve the players that are under them. And I think, with all respect to Major League Soccer, there are players on every roster that can definitely be improved, right? If you took over New York City FC, which is, you know, within the realm of possibility, given the City Football Group thing, maybe David Villa, he's not going to improve David Villa's game. If he has to work with Ben Sweat, he could probably teach him how not to go to ground so much and maybe how to adopt different defensive shapes. I'm really serious. I think he's a good enough coach to actually improve elements of individual players' games, which is a part of coaching.
All right. There you go. Daryl Grove feels Pep Guardiola would do very well at NYCFC.
Are you repeating what I said, or are you agreeing with me, or are you disagreeing with me?
Next question comes from Michael Hastings Black, who asks, in light of Wayne Rooney's upcoming testimonial match versus the U.S. men's national team, I was wondering what are the standard accepted practices for how this works in international football? Will Clint Dempsey get one? Does Tim Howard have to officially retire to get one?
And the other thing about Pep Guardiola is definitely answer Michael's question. There are no sort of standard practices, right? There is no rule book about how you get an international testimonial game. It's just at the whim of the federation or association of whether or not it happens. So
yeah.
It's really hard to say, here is what Dempsey or Howard, they have to hit these three marks, and then we give them a testimonial match. It's not how it works at all. Right?
And you don't necessarily even have to be retired or officially retired. That said, it helps, because otherwise you're basically being told that you've been retired.
It's a nudge-nudge.
A little bit.
Testimonial.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So I think generally speaking, it is rewarding a player. That's what a testimonial match is, right? It's mm-hmm. rewarding a player for long service by having one more match, usually against a like relevant or significant opponent, at least at club level. At national team level, I think it's more about just kind of appreciating the overall career and then maybe also making some money at the same time.
Yes. So here's a good example. In 2014, mm-hmm. Landon Donovan, who had famously been excluded from the 2014 World Cup squad, was offered a call-up in October against Ecuador in East Hartford, Connecticut, right? Mm-hmm. And that became sort of, it was an official international game. It wasn't against like a World 11 or anything. It was just a game that was scheduled against Ecuador. But Donovan, who was done with international football, was brought back for this one game so everybody could essentially, mm-hmm. when he gets subbed out, everybody applauds him. He can have that weird, awkward hug with Jürgen Klinsmann.
That's what everybody wanted.
Right? So Landon Donovan, to me, is the typical, prototypical, the exemplar mm-hmm. of an international footballer who has done so much for a nation. They absolutely deserve a sort of recognition and send-off, especially when they were their international career was very unceremoniously and surprisingly mm-hmm. ended way earlier than expected. I feel like we needed that moment.
Yes, except that, like, I agree with everything you said, except in Connecticut on like a Tuesday night against Ecuador in a friendly, that doesn't quite have the significance that maybe you would have expected, or at least you would have expected it to be at StubHub or in California.
Yes. So here's the other element of this. I read a lot, like doing a bit of research for this, I read a lot about how a lot of people suspected that at the time, this game against Ecuador was not selling that well in Connecticut, and that maybe one way of juicing attendance would be to make it.
That doesn't sound like US soccer.
Everybody turn out and applaud Landon Donovan game, which is another way some of these things happen.
I do feel like it's a Michael Scott line, but I do feel like U.S. soccer would have really said, let's all clap at Landon Donovan. Not applaud, but clap at Landon Donovan.
Which brings us to the Wayne Rooney one, though. So I get the feeling that this wasn't arranged mm-hmm. as the Wayne Rooney, everybody applaud Wayne Rooney for England send-off
clap
game.
Mm-hmm.
I think it just kind of happened to make sense.
Yep. Right?
Because England are playing the USA, and then suddenly we've got Rooney, he's out of the playoffs for mm-hmm. one thing. I think if he was in the playoffs, he wouldn't come back. This game would not have been arranged, right? DC out of the playoffs, Rooney's just finished his season. He quite, in a weird way, sacrificially retired from England to make Gareth Southgate's life easier, mm-hmm. is how I remember it.
Sure.
So this is a sort of a, it just, the timing just works perfectly to give it a thank you to Wayne Rooney. He gets a send-off, and they probably juice ticket sales a little bit.
I would say
so. For England versus USA. So it's not all cynical, and it's not all emotional and in tribute to Wayne Rooney. It's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
And it's kind of okay in that sense.
I feel like
England's a top goal scorer of all time.
That makes sense to me. Yeah, because I feel like you get maybe a few more Americans who happen to be living in England.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they want to go, or maybe a few more just kind of fans who wouldn't otherwise want to go see England play, but they have fond memories of mm-hmm. Wayne Rooney. He's been doing really well in the United States. So let's see Wayne Rooney one more time. It seems like he's got his confidence back a little bit. So let's see him playing for England one more game. Maybe he gets a goal, and then we can all say thanks, Rooney.
I think exactly that, yeah. Mm. So I think this works. In regards to, say, Tim Howard or Clint Dempsey, it would just be if they wanted it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in my head, Clint Dempsey, if you offered him something like this, he would say, nah, I'm fishing that weekend.
Yep, pretty much. I agree.
Can we have a Clint Dempsey fishing tournament? I could do that.
I would like that, yeah.
But so, like, some players I just don't think would want this level of attention. I could see Dempsey just being super awkward and mm-hmm. not okay with it. Tim Howard, maybe, and because he has that 2014 role mm-hmm. And he's not retired yet, I could see the US doing something like that for Tim Howard if he was up for it. Like one final call-up under Greg Berhalter or Tata Martino or whoever the coach is next year.
Yeah, there we go. I think more likely one than the other. It is always weird when you give a testimonial to a goalkeeper, though, because with a standard testimonial, you'll have that moment where there's a free kick that, like, Gary Neville probably wouldn't be taking a free kick for Manchester United, but in his testimonial, he gets to take a free kick.
Yeah.
Like, so you have those moments. I doubt we see Tim Howard running forward to take one, but maybe we do.
But if his team win a penalty,
yeah.
then
you could see.
Then maybe so. It's maybe worth going back a little bit to why testimonials exist in the first place, right? So the history of testimonials is that players didn't used to make that much money.
Right.
So that after you'd been at a club for, say, I think 10 years was the, not official, but the rough estimate, when you were thinking about retiring, the club would have a testimonial. Essentially, you would get the money from the testimonial for yourself.
Yeah.
And it was almost like a severance package. Mm-hmm. It was like a thank you for your service. Here's some money to help you get set up in your post-football career.
Yeah.
Now players are millionaires.
It's like a retirement party. Yeah.
It's a retirement party where you get some money, right?
Yeah.
So now it's more just the retirement party and the money will go to charity or something like that. So it's almost like a football tradition that was established for financial reasons that's just become a football tradition that we now follow.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's even, with that in mind, the tradition has changed a little bit because you do still have the one club men who get the testimonial for their long-standing service.
Yeah, Wayne Rooney didn't play for any of the national teams.
There we go. But you also have the ones where it sort of is like one or two seasons of a player – usually like near the end of their career that were significant to that club or to the fans, you can then get testimonials for that player that way. And it tends to be the ones who then are remembered like for the later club as opposed to the one they played with for like 12 years.
Yeah,
like the one, like, I think Henrik Larsson got one from Manchester United despite the fact that he played there for like 4 months. I think I'm correct in saying he ended up getting one.
Are you sure about that?
No, I'm not sure, but I think he did because he had like those two goals that were important in them winning the title.
The other similar-ish thing in terms of international football is, do you remember the Tony Meola game?
No.
So in Bruce Arena's first reign as US soccer coach, so before the 2006 World Cup, so it'd be either early 2006 or late 2005, Tony Meola was, I think, getting towards retirement, was on 99 caps. So they called him up for his 100th cap. So it became like the testimonial became his 100th cap game.
Yeah.
And he just played one game with no expectation of, I'm going to be a full-time international again. It was just, here's one more game just to say goodbye to Tony Meola.
I want other, like, or the next manager to do that, but only when they're in, like, a hot spot and say, I don't know, like if Tony Meola had only gotten 99 caps, to do it now. Like, Tony Meola gets his 100th cap. That's what we've been waiting for. You just call up ex-players from all over the place just to try to generate some goodwill. That's what I want to see.
After we met Tony Meola in Atlanta, he was a charming, wonderful man. He can have as many caps as he wants.
Still pretty fit, too. I feel like he'd be doing just fine up there. You kind of forget how big Tony Meola is until you're standing on a stage with him and you feel tiny.
Yeah.
And you realize that he could, like, pick you up with one hand by your head.
Speak for yourself. Anything else to add on testimonials? I'm especially interested in the Michael's question about Dempsey and Howard and players that may get it in the future.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't see it happening for some reason.
I don't either, and I think I say that because Landon Donovan is the one that comes most readily to mind for me from the U.S. national team. I'm sure there are other ones. I can't remember them. And so it's not as though it's a...
It's because Donovan was wronged as well in the 2014 thing. It's almost like, here's your little apology.
So I feel like, if anything, you'll get those. Like, Donovan's was a bigger deal. Maybe you'll get those, like, one final cap for this player, but you don't usually get a whole big, like, circus around it. So maybe you'll get some of those, but I also think maybe we'll just kind of see them stop playing for the national team. Maybe Clint Dempsey will get one more friendly in the summer or something like that.
Yeah.
But it won't necessarily be billed as a testimonial for Clint Dempsey.
How about if we start planning Christian Pulisic now?
Okay.
For like 2040?
Well, he will never retire because we're just gonna keep changing out the body parts with machine parts. Eventually, he'll be more machine than man, but he'll be able to play for the next 100 years.
Is that a new FIFA rule that's coming in?
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's a new Taylor rule that's coming in.
Rule.
Yes.
All right. I think we're going to have to reset the day since our last nonsense on the board.
We often do.
But thank you to Patrick and Michael for the questions. If you've got questions for us, totalsoccershow.com/questions. I will say there is, I don't want to name your shame, but there is one person that is sending in about 3 questions per day.
All right.
We've got to the point where that's so overwhelming, we can't even read those. So if you're that person, maybe just please slow down a little bit and just ask one question that you really want answered.
Nah, go more. Add more. Daryl will get back to all of them. Daryl will respond via email to every question. And I believe we've put a minimum word limit on your responses. He has to write at least 1,000 words to each question asked. So go ahead, keep asking. It'll work out. In the meantime, while Daryl responds to those, we've got some scouting reports to get to.
Oh, I forgot.
To close out the program.
Okay, I'm ready.
First one comes from William Hagans, scouting.
I found the page.
Attaboy. Scouting Brandon Cervania, the 19-year-old American midfielder for FC Dallas. Before I read this report from William on Brandon, Daryl, would you like to remind folks one more time what the Scouting Network is?
It is. Mm-hmm. It is where if you sign up to support the Total Soccer Show at totalsoccershow.com/join, we assign you a young player to keep an eye on. Then what we ask you to do, he said with a slight stutter, is send us once a week or every couple of weeks, when your player does something notable, go to totalsoccershow.com/report. Actually, that may not be the URL. And send us a quick report on what your player has been doing. We just want quick updates on what each player is up to so that we can keep tabs on all the young up-and-coming players around the world, including young Americans.
Yes, and then it's worth reiterating that this is one of the ways in which we keep the lights on and keep the equipment running and the podcast recording.
Yep, so the ad money is great, but this is the listener support is our base money that makes sure Total Soccer Show does not go away.
It's the bread and butter.
It's the bread and butter, yeah.
Neither of which Daryl eats.
I eat both bread and butter.
But intermittently, right? You're not a big bread guy.
No, not a big bread guy. No, yes. Not too many carbs.
Yes. It's just steak, right? Pure steak for you all the time?
It is not.
I know. William Higgins, scouting Brandon Cervania, the 19-year-old American midfielder for FC Dallas. After a quite productive season on loan with the Tulsa Roughnecks, Brandon was called into the U20 CONCACAF Championship. He was man of the match against Trinidad and has been regularly utilized as the team's number six. For more on that team, you can listen to this week's Top Drawer Soccer Show.
Yes, so Travis and I reviewed the first few games of the U20s in World Cup qualifying. Yeah, right. Savanio has been part of the midfield that is sometimes bypassed, but looks pretty good when they try.
I haven't listened to that show yet, but I feel like I can guess who advocated what sentiment about that team. I'm going to say one of you was more optimistic and positive than the other.
Actually, I was a little down on the U20s playing style. Okay. I feel like they're far too direct for the talent they have available and the level of team they're playing against.
I didn't say who was more optimistic.
Yeah, but I feel like I've offended your expectations, right?
You may have. You may have.
I also like to think that Brandon Savanya's productive season on loan with the Tulsa Roughnecks means that he drilled a lot of oil.
He did. That's what you have to do.
Jake Lamar is scouting Austin Trusty, the 20-year-old American centre-back for the Philadelphia Union. Jake says, the season has come to an end for Austin Trusty after a disappointing playoff game. Oh yeah, I saw it. However, he is one of the four outfield players to play every minute of the MLS season, like Sanchez, Zuzi and Birnbaum are the others. This is a testament to his consistency, and Jake will be extremely curious to see if any teams come knocking for him, which is something that Jim Curtin had expressed fear of throughout the season. Stay in MLS, Trusty. Get another year.
Nah, go to Chelsea. It'll work out. Steve Renard scouting Yuri Tielemans, 21-year-old Belgian midfielder for AS Monaco. Tielemans played two outstanding balls into Radamel Falcao, as well as making his own excellent run into the box to take a shot, but all three moves were foiled by fellow TSS scoutee Ethan Horvath during Monaco's 4-0 loss to Club Brugge in the Champions League. Monaco, not good. Things are unlikely to improve this weekend versus PSG, but perhaps Yuri's Belgian teammates will give him a more positive environment during the international break.
Oscar Leung is scouting Michael Obafemi, the 18-year-old Irish forward for Southampton. Oscar says that Michael Obafemi made his Premier League debut in Southampton's 6-1 loss to Manchester City. Came on the second half and kick-started multiple attacking opportunities. Manager Mark Hughes, said that Obafemi was equipped with unbelievable pace and would continue to get more chances as a super sub.
How would Mark Hughes do in MLS?
As a manager? Ooh, that is interesting.
As a player right now.
As a player right now, he'd score a couple.
I don't know which one he would do better at, and that's what I have to say about that. Manny Alcantara scouting Junior Firpo, 22-year-old Spanish left-back for Real Betis. Junior scored his first La Liga goal of the season in a 3-3 draw with RC Celta. Junior calmly buried a 1v1 opportunity going near post with his dominant left foot.
Ben Langevin is scouting Curtis Jones, the 17-year-old English midfielder for Liverpool. Ben says, Curtis Lil Gerard Jones tapped home a goal in the Reds' U19's 2-0 win against the Red Star Belgrade U18s in the UEFA Youth Cup. They're both U19. He's not breaking into the U23s as often as he was at the beginning of the year, but his Youth Cup performance has been definitely positive. Sounds like that game went better than the senior game for Liverpool.
Yes, I would say so. We need more U-something teams in the scouting report as well. Final report comes from Zibu A, scouting Lucero Cuevas. Or have we established, is it Lucero or Lucero Cuevas?
I think if you say one and I say the other, then all bases are good.
Lucero it is, 22-year-old Mexican striker for Club America. It's been a disappointing season for Cuevas, but she got back on the score sheet against Pumas in a 2-0 win. As America broke down the left wing, Lucero drifted off her defender's back shoulder before finishing emphatically at the far post. Well done, Lucero or Lucero.
Let's just go Cuevas. What up, Cuevas?
Yeah. Well done.
Thank you to everybody for the scouting reports. I've had a lot of requests for scouting assignments this week. Mm-hmm. That will definitely get done either today or tomorrow.
You're too busy writing your 1,000-word responses to
I've
all the questions.
I've had a little bit of a cold, so it knocked me out. Knocked me out for a day. But I'm back. I'm back, baby. All right. What have we got on tap to watch this weekend, Taylor? Because I do know it is an action-packed viewing schedule.
It is. Yes. So on Saturday, I say it is with the appropriate amount of trepidation. Saturday, 12:30 p.m., we've got Dortmund v. Bayern. That's a big one.
Der Klassiker is
Dortmund
what they started calling it.
Currently 4 points ahead of Bayern. Bayern, mm-hmm. who are in third place, even if – I forget which one it was. It was either Uli Hoeneß or Karl-Heinz Rummenigge refused to accept that they were in third place. Because he doesn't appreciate goal difference, is what
is
he said.
Right? Is
yes,
that right? Well, Dortmund are top. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a big, big game. If Dortmund can at least get a draw out of that, that's a huge performance.
I really hope it was Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, who then, like, as he walked away, mumbled, "We won't have that in the Super League." No goal difference.
No, you'll be eighth.
Yeah, perfect. At 3 p.m. on Saturday, Boca Juniors versus River Plate. That's kind of a big one.
3 p.m.?
That's what it was listed as on Soccerway. I had also seen it later in the evening, so maybe just check your listings mm-hmm. to figure out for yourself.
I do know as well that's going to be tough to watch. I know mm-hmm. it's on Fox Soccer Match Pass, which yeah. we subscribe to. I don't think it's on TV in the U.S., unless I'm only looking at English language channels.
You might be.
But you may have to get creative with where you find that game.
Well said.
He said, not breaking any laws by saying it.
There we go. There are obviously many other games on Saturday. Those are the two that we'll be keeping an eye on. On Sunday, you've got Manchester City versus Manchester United. You've got Monaco v PSG. You've got Milan Juve. Lots of stuff going on with
Arsenal
Milan
Wolves.
Juve.
You nearly forgot.
Of course, Arsenal Wolves. How could you not watch that? Yes, many, many other games to keep an eye on. But those are the big ones that I think we'll be potentially talking about at the beginning of next week,
yeah.
as we will all of the remaining second round fixtures of the MLS playoffs.
So I think what we'll do is have like a European / South American show and a Major League Soccer show.
Yarp.
We'll get both of those out there. We've got some watching to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to consider Seattle Portland as like a training stint ready for a long weekend of watching soccer.
Hooray.
Yeah.
Who needs sleep?
But life's good. I mean, you have to do that for work. That's not so bad.
It's true.
Yeah.
This is true.
Yeah.
This is true.
Watch some soccer and enjoy it, Taylor.
All right.
All right. Listeners, thank you for listening. Taylor, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today, even though you were up late last night.
Right back at you, buddy.
Listeners, thank you again for listening. We'll talk to you again after the weekend.